Alliance Physical Therapy Partners and Agile Virtual Care proudly presents Agile and Me, a physical therapy leadership podcast series, a podcast devised to help emerging and experienced therapy leaders learn more about various topics relevant to outpatient therapy services.
Welcome back to Agile and Me, a physical therapy leadership podcast series. Podcast devised to help emerging and experienced therapy leaders learn more about various topics relevant to outpatient therapy services. Today's podcast is titled Basics of a Compliance Program, and our guest is Tiffany Warden. Tiffany is currently the Clinical Compliance Officer for Alliance Physical Therapy Partners. Welcome, Tiffany.
Thank you, Richard.
What I'd like to do before we dive into the details and learn about compliance programs, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the listeners?
My name is Tiffany, and in 1998, I graduated from the University of Missouri, St. Louis, with a bachelor's degree, and worked for about 5 or 6 years with the Department of Corrections, and figured out that I needed to maybe move a little bit on in my career to something a little bit more challenging, and started looking around and developed an interest in working in the medical field. So in 2003, I resigned my position with the Department of Corrections, and I went ahead and went after a certification in medical coding and billing. 2005, I did complete the program and became a certified professional coder, and I began working for a local PT practice in Missouri as a claims manager. After a couple of years, again, I started looking for new challenges within, you know, my current organization, and eventually talked them into reorganizing their annual regulatory training program and their medical records production program and their credentialing programs. I went on to review their OSHA programs and their medical liens and DME provider programs, and just finally figured out that my forte was in evaluating programs and implementing changes that streamlined the process and followed all of the regulatory requirements that they were required to follow. In 2013, Agility Health hired me as their outpatient compliance officer, and that following year, I actually went back to school and obtained my professional compliance officer certification. And I now serve as the compliance officer for Alliance Physical Therapy Partners, and I oversee our compliance program as well as the medical records and credentialing departments.
What actually is the role of a clinical compliance officer? I'd love to know a little bit more about what the duties, responsibilities are of such a position.
Yeah, it's an interesting position because from a high level, you have to act as sort of the guardrails of the company. You have to know enough about each area of compliance, your coding, your billing, the administration side of it, the clinical activities, risk management, and so on. You've got to know a little bit in every area in order to develop a program to where you are effectively, as I said, the guardrails for that company, making sure everybody stays on the same general path and is following the same general rules in order to achieve what we believe is the most compliant and ethical way to run that business.
Yeah, you make it sound so simple. You know, I always say managing or leading clinicians is like herding cats. So I can just imagine trying to keep clinicians within certain guardrails. I'm sure it's a challenging position, if nothing else.
It is at times.
And then obviously the role, as you say, is to kind of have those guardrails or bumper bars, whatever one wants to call them. Obviously, there's a lot to the job. What type of responsibilities does the clinical compliance officer have? We talked a little about the kind of the role, but what are the responsibilities?
I would say the main responsibility is education. So not only do you have to have that high level awareness of all of the areas where, you know, compliance, where you have a compliance risk or a legal risk, you've got to make sure that you are educating your staff and the rest of the members of your company on where those risks lie and how to avoid those risks. It's easy to say that, well, everybody follows the rules and nobody gets into trouble. But again, you said the herding cats reference. It is. When you are running a larger company, you're dealing with different people in different roles, clinical, non-clinical, and so on. And so you've got to get everybody on the same page and educate, educate, educate in those areas to make sure that, you know, this is where you need to be operating, where it is within those guardrails.
You know, when I worked in hospitals, you know, the threat of the compliance officer was always kind of an ominous threat, or seemed to be. And I always found it strange to call them officers almost, where, you know, like you said, really, the primary role is to educate and to coach and cajole and to encourage. And only a small part of it truly is what I would say policing. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. Because if you educate a working staff properly, you really minimize the amount of that policing that you have to do on the backside of things.
The first question a lot of certainly smaller practices would ask is, you know, why bother? Why do I need a compliance program? It's a distraction. It takes time away from patient care. How would you answer that?
I think it's all in how you look at it. And so I always try to approach it from the point of view that if I know the rules, I know what I can do and I know what I cannot do. And I like to focus on what I can do. And again, having that education, having that knowledge, it just allows you, even in a smaller practice, if you know where your guardrails are, you know where you have to stay on the road. Because you know as well as I do, in some of the smaller practices, these clinicians are pulled in 1,000 different directions. And oftentimes, it's very, very easy to get pulled off. You know, you pull your focus off of what it is that you should be doing, and you're just distracted by these little things that probably matter, right? But don't matter as much as the overall idea of getting somewhere in a compliant and ethical manner. And so I like to approach it from that perspective.
Yes, it shouldn't really be a question of why do I need one. It's really a question of, do I want to have a business or not? In order to have a business and for it to continue to exist, you really have to focus on compliance first and foremost, don't you? It's left, right, and center.
That is true. That is definitely true.
I always say, when they're talking to clinicians, is, you know, one has to operate a compliant quality business in a fiscally responsible manner. And there's a reason why I put compliance at the front, because if you're not compliant, you can't deliver care and you won't have the doors open. So everything else is academic unless you have that first foundational piece. Would you agree?
I would agree with that.
What external entities do we have to be in compliance with? So we talk about compliance as being topic, but also we have to be compliant with third parties, and is that right? And which ones might they be?
You have to consider that you're operating on essentially three levels: the federal level, the state level, and then sometimes your local level, your county level or city level. And so I guess from a federal level, I would always focus on the Office of Inspector General. You know, they oversee, you know, any issues that happen with Stark, any issues that happen with kickback, the anti-kickback statute, and any of those federal laws, fraud, waste, abuse. These are the guys that are always looking and auditing and making sure that, you know, that the providers are following and are in compliance with those guidelines. The good thing about them is that they publish a work product every year. And how that helps us is that it literally is a list of items that they're looking at, and it's always based on the previous year's activity. And if they notice a trend or a topic that is continually coming up with providers, or if we're failing audits in specific areas, they're going to put it on the list. And so if you just go out and you take a look at the list, they might seem like a big scary organization at first, but they are handing you everything you need to know about what they're going to be looking at, and maybe where you can start looking internally for ways to improve your process and or your outcomes. Another one, of course, is CMS. Nobody can forget CMS. CMS runs Medicare Part B, and their rules are enshrined within regulations. And so when we consider that, we are essentially, when we follow Medicare rule, we are actually following the law. And as such, you have to consider that bleeds out into your other federal programs. So your TRICARES and your CHAMPUS and your TriWest and veterans and so on and so on. So that covers a long list of insurances, including Medicare Advantage programs that are offered by private insurers. You know, those guidelines and rules actually apply down the line. So that's always a good place to go and pay attention to because everything's published for everyone to take a look at and read. Everybody has access to it at cms.gov, and it applies, you know, pretty much across the board. Well, I think the big bad, if I can call it that, is the Office of Civil Rights. And civil rights encompasses, you know, they have HIPAA. And HIPAA is sometimes this area to where, you know, you think if you keep, you know, your patient's information private that you're good to go, but there's so much more for HIPAA. It's not about just keeping it private. It's about how you store it, how you send it, how you transmit it, how you retain it, any number of things. If it affects PHI, HIPAA is probably going to have a rule about it. And so HIPAA is one of those areas that OCR is especially active in, especially these days. And so that's one of the ones I think that you should always pay attention to. And we talk about civil rights too. We talk about access to care, interpreters, you know, sign language interpreters, English, if they have English as a second language, we've got to be able to offer them these services so that they have access to the quality care that they should have access to. So those at the federal level, I think, are the ones that are foremost in our mind, just simply because they govern really what we see as ethical behavior, generally speaking, in the healthcare field.
We'll continue the conversation after a short music break and advertisement.
Most orthotic manufacturers take a one-shape-fits-all approach to solving lower body pain and symptoms. They focus on arch support for temporary pain relief, which can end up leading to inefficiencies and injuries. That's where BioCorrect is different. More than just an insert, BioCorrect is a fully customizable foot orthotic system engineered to address and treat biomechanical imbalances of the entire body. And we're backed by more than 25 years of experience. To learn more, visit us at BioCorrect.com.
Welcome back to Agile and Me, a physical therapy leadership podcast. Obviously, if we're not compliant, there are consequences. What type of consequences are there depending on non-compliance, if that makes sense?
Well, I think the two that are at the forefront of everyone's mind are an audit. So you're engaging in a billing practice or a coding practice or a collections practice. That is, it's a little bit skewed outside of the normal expectations for your provider type, then you're going to call attention to yourself, whether it be for Medicare or one of the other federal agencies or even a private payer, because private payers have their own sets of rules and regs that we have to follow. And so you call attention to that, and you could instigate an audit, which almost always instigates a payback. And so there's that financial incentive to stay on the right path and to continually always try, you know, to do that right thing. The other part is you look at those agencies we just talked about. You look at OIG, you look at OCR. These entities have the ability to bring charges against not only the companies, but the individuals within the companies. And so whether they be a civil charge or a criminal charge, it's no longer just the big players that are at risk. It's the individual players within the smaller businesses that are at risk, because everybody is a stakeholder in creating a culture of compliance in any given company, and everybody's expected to participate and be knowledgeable about what it is that they're expected to do.
There's certainly some severe and serious consequences, aren't there, if we don't follow the rules? And that's not whether, you know, there is no excuses there with regards to, well, I didn't know. It doesn't matter if there was an intent or not, you still suffer the consequences of non-compliance, don't you?
That is very true. The assumption is, if you're in this business, it is your business to know what the rules are, and intent is not necessarily considered in some of these agencies.
My perception is the small enterprise or the independent clinic owner may feel that larger entities perhaps sail closer to the wind or operate outside of what would be perceived as appropriate boundaries. But I believe it's quite the opposite. I think the larger the entity, the bigger the target on the back, and the more compliant one has to be, squeaky clean. What's your thoughts on that?
I would genuinely agree with that. I mean, it just makes sense. If you are running a bigger business and you have millions of dollars running through your coffers at any given time, you are going to be a target because they're going to look at you. The volume of claims coming through to the payers, the volume of money coming through to the business from governmental payers. And it's a larger footprint equals a larger amount of risk. And it is up to those larger organizations who have those resources to make sure that they have a program that appropriately assesses the risks and creates the necessary culture within the company to be compliant and ethical in all of their practices. So yeah, yes. I would agree.
Yes. Now, obviously, for small, independent, private practices, they don't have the resources for somebody like yourself, a clinical compliance officer. How would a small practice go about setting up a compliance program, would you say?
I would concentrate probably in three areas at first. But the first area I would say is review your contracts. You have to know what it is that you are obligated to do. If you know what it is you're obligated to do, you can develop policies and procedures to compliantly get there. And that's not only for CMS, which again, everything's published, you can go out and read it, but your commercial payers also publish their contracts. You have your contracts, of course, but they also publish provider manuals. So it would behoove practice owners to go and read those. Because their rules may be slightly different than Medicare. Essentially, everybody's doing the same, but there are some differences in how you code and what documents are required and how you calculate your billable units. But ultimately, you need to know what it is that you are supposed to be doing. So that's the idea number one. Number two, I would get really, really up close and personal with HIPAA. The government publishes all kinds of information. For HIPAA, you know, you can go out to HIPAA.gov, you can go out to any number of websites and read down the very basics of HIPAA. It will outline all of your responsibilities in terms of safeguarding PHI from an administrative perspective, from a physical perspective, from a security perspective, because you have HIPAA privacy and you have HIPAA security obligations. And so I would highly recommend that they take some time to go review that information and make sure that they know what their obligations are when it comes to handling PHI and the like. And the third thing I would recommend is that they know their coding. Your diagnostic coding, your procedural coding, all of your coding needs to be tight. And you've got to make sure that you know how to support the codes that you are billing in your documentation. And if you are really, if you take some time to just look at those three areas, what you have is a very, very solid foundation to start building your compliance program up, even at the smaller level.
Yeah, it's not enough to just provide the care, is it? You have to document it in a specific way and also relate it to function and, you know, the why. So I think that trips up a lot of clinicians, doesn't it?
It does, because there's a saying on the administrative side of medicine, and that is, if it's not documented, it's not done. It was never done. And so you may think that you are putting your ideas down, but what you have to do is you've got to go through and make sure you're checking some boxes and that the required information is there to support what you're doing, because your biggest risk always comes from what you're putting out. And what you're putting out are bills. You're putting out claims with codes on them. And then every once in a while, you've got to put out the documentation to support those, whether it be in an audit or whether it be just a regular part of the billing process for that payer.
What are the basic building blocks of a robust compliance program for a smaller entity? What do they need to focus on as it pertains to having a compliance program that they can show to a potential auditor?
The three areas that we just talked about, I think, are where you start. And then what I think where you take it from there, two important areas are, we talked about this, education. There are pieces of education that are required on an annual basis. You have your fraud, waste, and abuse training, your HIPAA training, your civil rights training, and so on. These are areas to where you need to make sure that not only as a smaller business owner that you know what your obligations are, but that your other staff know what they are. Because from the time the patient walks into the door to the time the patient walks out of the door, there are rights that attach to them as a patient. And you've got to make sure that you are aware of what it is that you have to provide. If they do not speak English, you have to provide an interpreter. Sometimes you have to, you know, just provide a service that allows them to receive the same level of care as anybody else that would walk in there that could do the things that they cannot do. So educating at that regulatory education is something that private practice owners need to know, and then they need to make sure that their staff know. So educate, educate, educate. And then from that regulatory side of things, you go into, again, you address that billing and coding and documentation side. That's also important, but it's covered under that education section. And then the second thing, I guess it would be a total of five things here, is that you have to audit. So you have to take a look at what you're producing, what your staff is producing, and you have to make sure that it's within the rules. We are required as healthcare providers to have a compliance plan in place. And part of any good compliance plan is that auditing function. And whether it be a look at many different subjects, you know, a look at how this code is used or how the goals are being formed or what kind of prior medical history is being collected and documented in the medical record, or whether it's just something about just a general full-on audit of a chart and you take a look at how they're performing from admission to discharge. Whatever you can do is what you need. Whatever your resources are, you need to be doing that.
We'll continue the conversation after a short music break and advertisement.
Agile EMR is a comprehensive all-in-one electronic medical records solution created by physical therapists for physical therapists. Features include everything you need to run your physical therapy practice in one place. To schedule a demonstration of Agile EMR, visit our website at www.agiletherapyemr.com.
Welcome back to Agile and Me, a physical therapy leadership podcast. To help clinicians stay on the straight and narrow, what tends to be a couple of common pitfalls that you've seen or often identified within the outpatient clinic setting that result in non-compliance?
I think one of the most common ones I see are a default to a certain coding methodology. That sounds a little bit more complicated than what it actually is, but I think what I sometimes see is that I see clinicians billing a certain code because they're comfortable that they know what that code means and they're comfortable that it's going to be covered and paid. That's not the end of the story there, right? So it's got to be, you know, your coding has always got to match your clinical intent. And that's where, with physical therapy especially, that's where coding gets a little bit fuzzy, because in a lot of other professions, what you have is you've got a code that means something and that's what it means, period. But with physical therapy, you use a code based on your clinical intent. So the same thing that you do with one patient, you can do it with another patient, but have a completely different intent, maybe at a functional level or a neuromuscular level. You've got to take into account what your intent is. So that's one of the biggest items that I see, is that we fall back into using codes that, again, we're comfortable with, they're commonly used, but they don't really reflect what it is that we're doing within that treatment session with the patient. The other one is knowing the rules of the payer that you're dealing with. And this is a lot of times a little bit more of an administrative issue, because when you're looking at a payer's rule set, you're really looking at how they want you to code and how they want you to accumulate units and how they want you to bill. But therapists have to be aware of this as well, because it affects how they track their time and how they calculate their units and how they schedule their patients. There's so many ripple effects out there from this particular area. It's just something that I feel really strongly that clinicians be educated on, and that is that, you know, there are two ways to calculate units, and certain payers follow this and certain payers follow that. So the more aware they are of that, the more compliantly that they can bill and code and document.
It's amazing, I think, the amount of dollars that are left on the table for the work that clinicians do, but they just don't bill in the appropriate manner for the specific payer. And we're just giving away care and time, aren't we, as a profession? It's remarkable.
Yes.
If we move to looking forwards, how has the COVID pandemic changed the compliance landscape to this point?
COVID has really brought the subject of infection control into the picture. And with an outpatient clinic, you know, we're a physical therapy outpatient company. And when we look at what our obligations are from an infection control standpoint, we all know that we've got to clean the table, we've got to clean the equipment, we've got to do this and that. But what COVID brought in was a little bit more of an awareness of how we do that and the extent to which we do that. And then also how we interact with our patients as they come into the clinic. So we have to deal with the fact that we've got to screen the patients and we've got to document that we screen the patients. So we have to have a process and policy in place. And then we have to continually keep them spaced apart. You know, you're 6 feet apart and you've got to make sure that they're wearing a mask and that you're cleaning anything that they touch in between and we're washing our hands and doing all of these things that we all washed our hands before COVID, right? And we cleaned the equipment before COVID. But I think the pandemic has made it a little bit, it's made us all a little bit more cognizant of the fact that infection control practices do exist. And guess what? They exist in a physical therapy office. I view this as positive. I think this is an area where it might, you know, what I'm about to say might be a little bit controversial, but I have had experience with PTs in the past saying that, well, we're just a physical therapy clinic. But on the other hand, they argue that, oh, we're medical professionals. We are the experts in body mechanics and movement. You got to pick a corner. And you have to decide from what corner you're going to start your argument and how you're going to build that out. And I think with COVID, with us having to undergo the same infection control practices and screening practices, and us, you know, we were declared essential workers and we were never really shut down. And that's great because I think people will remember the fact that, oh, look, they were a medical provider and they were never shut down either. We're not just physical therapists. We provide an essential service. We provide a medical service, a necessary service to our patients. And I think that COVID helped our providers realize that they're not just physical therapists. They are a full-on partner in the medical field treating patients alongside the doctors. And that is a positive for me. The other thing I think is it sets some new rules. Again, I go back to you have to know what it is that you're supposed to do. And in the area of outpatient practice, you had some rules that dealt with infection control and worker safety standards and health standards, but they weren't cohesive. And now what I see is that there's this rule set that's coming together and it is becoming cohesive. And I think it's here to stay. But we know what we now have to do in terms of infection control and keeping our patients safe and keeping our staff safe, not just through COVID, but through cold season, through flu season, through anything else that may pop up that where we have to go back to these standards. We know what they are now, and we know them right out of the gate.
As well as the infection control component, there's been a monumental shift as it pertains to telehealth services and therapy. Can you just give us your insight as to what changed and what you think will happen in the future as it pertains to telehealth and therapy services?
Sure. I think if I can have a favorite part of the pandemic, I think my favorite part would be where we had more access to our patients and our patients had more access to us. And I think that's always a good thing. With telehealth, we had a lot of, you know, we had 50 states, 50 different sets of rules as to who could do it, how they could do it, whether it was synchronous or asynchronous, transmission, so many rules, what codes could be used, what we can do, what we cannot do. And so I think that brought, with telehealth, I was really, first we went back and forth about who could do it and what payers would pay for it and whether patients would benefit from it. But I think within just the first few months, our profession and the medical field in general determined that, hey, this is a valid way that we can access our patients safely And I think it's great. I think it's here to stay. We are seeing some movement on the private payer side, or the commercial payer side, where they are putting telehealth as a permanent benefit to their patients. So that's always a plus. We haven't seen CMS do that yet. That was a little bit disappointing because that was a quest this year that unfortunately did not make it into the final rule. The other positive I see is increased access via direct access. With physical therapy, a lot of times you have to have a script. There are states that are wide open that say you can see a physical therapist for anything as long as you want. And there are states that say, well, you can see this physical therapist, but you know, you've got to go right back to your doctor and tell him why you saw him and get a script and take it back, and then it'll be covered. And so I think with COVID, what we had was a little bit of a movement forward in how patients can access us. And we actually have seen movement in the direct access laws in about 7 different states. And by movement, I mean movement forward, where they're opening it up. So I do think that we do see some positives coming out of this in regards to, like I said, our access to our patients' access to us, and how we can really move our own profession forward in a way that emphasizes the care and the quality of care that we bring to these patients and their outcomes and the way that they are able to live their daily lives.
Yes, I never thought I'd hear somebody say they had a favorite part of the pandemic. So congratulations on that. But I would certainly agree with regards to the idea that COVID has been a catalyst of change. I think change was occurring, but it certainly allowed a paradigm shift to occur rather than this small drip of change that has been occurring over an extended period of time, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And I think it's been a good thing.
We'll continue the conversation after a short music break and advertisement.
The world around us is changing at a rapid pace, and so is our preference for how, where, and when we choose healthcare. That's where Agile Virtual Care answers the call. Agile Virtual Care is a comprehensive telehealth solution, revolutionizing physical therapy by making PT convenient, safe, and accessible across the entire country. For providers and employers looking to offer employees different options for preventative and continual care, Agile Virtual Physical Therapy delivers the comfort and convenience that patients want and the quality care they deserve from experienced, licensed therapists.
Welcome back to Agile and Me, a physical therapy leadership podcast. How do you see the regulatory landscape changing in the future? I tend to see further regulatory requirement. I hope that you can say something different than that, but what's your perception as it pertains to the regulatory landscape?
So two things come to mind, strictly from an administrative standpoint, and that is the movement, again, towards direct access. But as an offshoot of that, what had been proposed to CMS was that we relieve some of the administrative burden on PTs. We have clinicians that are educated at this point to the doctoral level. And why on earth do we need a signature on a plan of care for a patient that was either referred to us or decided that they came to see us if we are the experts in movement, in body mechanics, and you know, if we can contribute without pharmaceutical intervention with pain management practices with our patients? Why do we need that additional level? Why do we need that administrative burden there? So we are looking at possibly having that. It's a dream, really, from a compliance perspective, because it's one less thing we have to worry about. But to have that requirement for people that are accessing us with a prescription to no longer have to have that signed plan of care. So I look at them as relieving that administrative burden. The other administrative burden that I'm seeing trying to go away are the idea of these rules that govern what we can do and what we can't do during a session that we can or cannot bill together. And I won't bore anybody and go into my soapbox speech on the NCCI edits, but what we're seeing is we're seeing a movement to relieve us of the burden of having to add additional modifiers to codes when we are trying to document our care for this patient and having to bill these codes in a certain way or append this or that after the fact. We need to be focused on treating our patients, and we need to be focused on documenting what we are doing with them. We do not need this extra administrative burden of, well, let's get this signed, even though we're never really going to ask you for it unless there's an audit, or let's try and bill our codes this way and put all of these modifiers on there. There's just no reason for that.
I always feel as a clinician that we're almost trying to be tripped up to prevent payment. I'm a firm believer that one needs to document appropriately and accurately, but you know, even with that, sometimes it still isn't sufficient for certain payers. And I definitely agree that the signature component and the modifier codes would be huge moves forwards for the clinic and the profession.
I agree. And I think the other side of that, on the patient side of what we're looking at moving forward, are there are going to be more rights allocated to the patient. And I don't know if you've read it, but I've read the proposed rule to update HIPAA. And what these rules are doing are they're shifting the power to the patient. Right now, HIPAA does a great job, I think, of requiring providers to provide records and the like and protect the information of its patients. But they want to move that forward because, again, this is under the OCR, the Office of Civil Rights. And so privacy is, think about that. It's governed under the Office of Civil Rights that deals with our privacy. And so what they're doing is they're shifting the rights away from the provider to the patient. And so I think we are looking at maybe a future of patient empowerment here.
Before we finish up, I would love any final thoughts or advice for our listeners as it pertains to kind of compliance issues at the current time.
My final thought would be if we've talked about knowing what your obligations are. And once you do that, if you see a problem, address it. Half the problem is solved when you address it. And one of the things that some of these regulatory agencies look at is, okay, they found a problem. Now what did they do? This is where they're focusing their attention. What did you do after you found out that that was a problem? And they want to see that the company, big or small, made a good faith effort to resolve whatever issue, you know, reared its head in that particular incident. So if you have a problem, if you see a problem, address the problem, make a good faith effort to correct it, and document what you've done, and, you know, keep a record of these things, because ultimately, as a small practice owner, you are going to be responsible for what happens within that company. And again, half your battle is, one, once you address it effectively. And I couldn't recommend that any more than I am right now.
Yeah, philosophy of life. If you mess up, fess up.
Exactly.
On that note, thank you, Tiffany, for your time today. I've really appreciated talking to you and learning a little bit more about compliance and what a clinical compliance officer does. And I'm sure that the listeners appreciate it as well. So thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by Alliance Physical Therapy Partners and Agile Virtual Care. For more information, please visit our websites, alliancepTP.com and agilevirtualcare.com. Make sure to follow us on social media and LinkedIn, where you can learn more about Alliance Physical Therapy Partners and Agile Virtual Care.